Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Thank you for joining us in this, the latest edition of the OIS podcast series. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm a Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by a good friend, Martin Lambert, who's Senior Research Fellow at the OIS, who heads up the OIS Energy Transition Hydrogen Module. And we're here today to talk about hydrogen, the current challenges in creating viable business cases. Now, Martin and I attended a conference in Vienna in the middle of March, a couple of weeks ago. And you specifically chaired the European Hydrogen Conference, which followed that European Gas Conference. So perhaps you could share with us some of the key insights from that event, in a way, kind of to set the agenda for this podcast.
Sure. I mean, I think the first thing to emphasize, as you said, the conference happened actually on 23rd of March, 1 month after the start of the Russian military action in Ukraine. And so clearly everybody there, both the gas conference and the hydrogen conference, was very interested in energy security. Also, the conference was hard on the heels of the European Commission publication called Repower EU. That came out on the 8th of March, and it was set as a reaction to the Russian invasion in Ukraine, and it was setting out even more ambitious targets for low-carbon hydrogen production by 2030. And so we had quite a lot of debate around how that could be achieved and how realistic was it. One other comment, I think, as well on the agenda, it was that I'd been at the gas conference the previous day, and I was really struck there by, despite it being a gas conference, there was a huge amount talked about hydrogen. To some extent, maybe it was gas industry people trying to say, well, there's a gaseous fuel in the future called hydrogen, and blue hydrogen is important, so they were sort of talking their own book. To some way, but still, I was really struck by how much hydrogen talk there was at the gas conference. But if I move on then to your question about setting the agenda for this podcast, at the hydrogen conference, I'd say the key takeaways were around more realism about what hydrogen could achieve and where some of the challenges are. For example, starting on the demand side, around end uses, there was much more talk about what people call hard to abate sectors. And so using hydrogen as an industrial feedstock for making so-called e-fuels, so synthetic low carbon fuels, and then for heavy transport. And that seems the right direction. So there's less talk now about hydrogen being a direct natural gas substitute, for example, like millions of households for space heating and that sort of thing. So that's one takeaway. The other one was about more realism, perhaps, around transport of hydrogen. So let's talk about long-distance imports. We're more likely to be seeing pipeline imports in Europe from southern Spain or North Africa, and less likely to see liquid hydrogen being shipped halfway around the world. So liquid hydrogen is very different from LNG. So that was another sort of key takeaway. Just mentioned as ammonia, perhaps is something where long distance trade could work. And then finally, I think a big takeaway was around hydrogen storage being more important. And I think hydrogen storage is really important for hydrogen's value proposition to compete with batteries, but recognition really that not much had been done, or not enough had been done, to figure out how we're going to actually get to enough of those storage volumes. And then the final topic, I think, for our agenda was to geopolitics, because that whole energy security thing underpinned really a lot of what we talked about there. I guess I should also, just before I finish this little introductory bit, I should also say that a lot of the reason why we could talk about these things now is that we're just now launching the OIES Energy Transition Hydrogen Research Module. In fact, we've got the kickoff meeting with sponsors next week, and that's really focusing on how to build business cases for the hydrogen economy. So this really moving on, I think, from bold ambition to our research now is going to be focused on how are we going to be achieving these things and what needs to be done to make it happen. So that would be my sort of agenda for us to talk about.
No, Martin, I think that's really good. And, you know, I agree with you. In the main conference, there was a lot of discussion about hydrogen. But it's certainly, you know, you have listed a lot of interesting topics. So why don't we dig into some of them a bit further and also kind of discuss specifically the research which you'll be doing as part of the Energy Transition Hydrogen Research Module. So let's start with the impact of the Ukraine situation and the RePower EU document. Is hydrogen a realistic pathway to achieve net zero in Europe? And, you know, what is your view about the ambitions in the RePower EU?
I mean, I think to pick up one of your questions there first, I mean, is hydrogen a realistic pathway to net zero? I think it's kind of, yes, it has a role to play, but it's not going to be, I think I wrote a paper earlier on our website about hydrogen not being the silver bullet. So it has a role, but it won't be doing everything. But then if I focus on on the RePower EU part of your question, I think the RePower EU document really majored on ambitious targets, but was pretty unclear on how it was going to be achieved. And that, you know, in a way, wasn't surprising. It was written quite rapidly, came out on the 8th of March, 2 weeks after the invasion. But important now, I think, that through our research, and indeed through the EU themselves, it needs to really focus on the how aspect. But in terms of that document, though, perhaps if I could actually digress from hydrogen for a moment, it's worth mentioning about renewable gases in general, because you can't really separate hydrogen from renewable gas. And in our research, we do look at both. But the RePower EU talks about 35 BCM of biomethane by 2030, compared to the previous target of 17 BCM in the Fit for 55 document, which came out middle of last year. And given that total biomethane today, having been building up over a few years, is still only about 3 BCM, then, you know, 3 BCM to 17 BCM is already quite a stretch over the next 8 years. 3 BCM to 35 BCM sounds even more of a stretch, but actually not impossible by any means, and probably because with high gas prices, then investments in biomethane start to look really quite doable. Perhaps investors need some confidence that those prices will carry on for a while, so some sort of contract for difference structure. But it'd be, I think, given the track record of how biogas production grew, particularly in Germany between, say, 2011 and 2015, I'd say that biomethane target in the RePower EU document with the right government policy really could be achieved. And so that sounds quite reasonable. If I go back to hydrogen after that, then RePower EU set the target of 20 million tonnes of renewable hydrogen by 2030. That's 10 million tonnes of imports and 10 million tonnes produced within Europe. And that's quite a big step up from the 5.6 million tonnes talked about in Fit 55. And if you bear in mind that each million tonnes of green hydrogen needs about 50 terawatt hours of electrical input, so that, again, 1 million tonnes needs about 13 to 20 gigawatts of capacity. So 10 million tonnes is 130 to 200 gigawatts of capacity in 8 years' time. And that's a huge amount of additional renewable power. And given that the largest electrolyzer projects today, they're building one coming up for 100 megawatts. So there's a huge scale up to get from 100 megawatts to over 100 gigawatts by 2030. So big ambition, and we're struggling currently. We'll look at it further in our ongoing research. But I think definitely more emphasis on the hydrogen part, on the how is going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely, Martin. I completely concur with that. But you also talk about hydrogen's main use being in the kind of the hard-to-abate sectors. You know, so can you share with our listeners What are the hard-to-abate sectors and how do you stimulate demand in them?
Well, so the first use is hydrogen as a feedstock. So there's current industrial use, feedstock in refineries, petrochemicals and ammonia. And they're hard to abate because you can't use anything else. I mean, yeah, there's no chance. You can't, if you want it as a feedstock, it's really got to be hydrogen. And the next new industry is steelmaking, which is also a feedstock industry. So the hydrogen there is used as a reducing agent for reducing the iron ore through the direct reduced iron process. And that requires investment in new hardware by steel companies. So we've got a paper under development at the moment about hydrogen in steelmaking. So that should be coming out later on this year. And that will look at some of the issues around justifying that investment. So it's really about things to like carbon contract differences could be a way to justify those kind of investments.
You mentioned the paper's actually ongoing on hydrogen in steelmaking. Just let our listeners know, we will, of course, do a podcast on that. So you'll be able to join that and listen to that at the OIS podcast series. You mentioned earlier on, Martin, one of the things that was discussed at the conference in Vienna was the transportation of hydrogen. So perhaps you could share with our listeners, Kenny, you know, what are the challenges about that? You know, maybe and potentially what are the solutions? What's the research you're doing on that?
Yeah, so that was another observation from the conference and from our ongoing research, is that I think to start with, people had the impression that hydrogen would be, it's a gas, so it's pretty similar to natural gas, and so maybe liquid hydrogen would be quite like LNG. But I think there's been growing realisation that liquid hydrogen is really fundamentally different to LNG. I mean, for one thing, hydrogen liquefies at minus 250 degrees C, whereas LNG minus 160 degrees. So that's quite a big difference. But okay, and that affects then the metals that you need for carrying the stuff and that sort of thing. But even more relevant, I think, is the energy you need to liquefy it. So for liquid hydrogen, it looks like you're at 20 or 25% of the energy content in the liquefaction process. And that's a huge amount of the energy. And then there's not really shipping at scale yet. So there's one very small demonstration ship, which has now carried one cargo from Australia to Japan, will carry some more. But it's going to be very, I mean, I'm not sure we're ever going to see LNG carrier-sized vessels carrying liquid hydrogen, just because the economics don't really stack up. Having said that, hydrogen by pipeline is much closer to natural gas. And so I think, as I said at the start, I think people are seeing imports from Spain or North Africa could be quite realistic. So a pipeline to bring it to Northern Europe, that could be could work. But fundamentally, hydrogen is much, much more local than natural gas. So you aren't going to see the same quantity of long-distance shipments that you get in natural gas. And then finally, then all of this needs a business case for investment, which is kind of part of what we're looking at. It's part of our hydrogen module. And one comment also got talked about in Vienna was that the latest EU regulatory proposals suggest that hydrogen infrastructure will be quite separate from gas infrastructure, which I think is a bit of an issue for gas transmission companies who hope to make a case to convert their gas infrastructure to hydrogen. Instead, they need to sell it to a ring-fenced entity, and that will put more challenges in as well. So there needs to be something about how that's going to work for converting infrastructure from gas to hydrogen.
So there are challenges in the transportation of hydrogen. As you said, these are areas and together with business models, you know, you're going to be addressing in your research. But one of the things you mentioned earlier on is also the storage of hydrogen, and that in a way it's a key proposition, it's a value proposition which people have been talking about for hydrogen. So can you perhaps tell us a bit more about, you know, why the storage of hydrogen is such a key element in the argument and the business case?
Yeah, sure. I mean, storage, as I said, I think recognition in Vienna that maybe storage was something which had been a bit underexplored and under-researched, and so it's something which we certainly are planning to pick up on. Because, I mean, I think the current Ukraine situation has really emphasized the importance of storage and indeed the desire to refill gas storage in the course of this year. And so that, and the hydrogen's proposition is that it's a medium for long-term energy storage. So that's pretty important. The snag is, though, that hydrogen storage isn't directly related to gas storage. So we know hydrogen can be stored in salt caverns, and there's four of those, a couple in the UK, a couple in the US, which are currently in operation and is proven technology that works well. There are some salt caverns currently used for gas storage in Europe, and so those could be converted potentially. But a lot of gas storage in Europe is in disused gas fields or other hydrocarbon reservoirs, and that's a lot more tricky because you might put in hydrogen and not get hydrogen back. Also, even converting a salt cavern doesn't happen overnight, because you need to clean out all of the methane that was there and maybe expand the salt cavern, a bit more leaching through flushing out with water. And so that takes time as well. And all of that needs a business case. And so it will take time to do that. Another new thing from the Ukraine situation was then a realization that actually there's a concern about need to free up gas infrastructure be available for hydrogen. For example, there was some talk, not yet confirmed, but you know, would the Groningen field, for example, would that come back into production or stop the decline in production in order to provide more energy security? So maybe stripping out gas infrastructure too early to convert to hydrogen is not such a good idea either. So, but I think the key thing on storage, though, is that to date, not enough work has been done, either technically or commercially. And so as part of our research, we're going to be looking at the commercial models for making the case for expanding on that hydrogen storage.
Yeah, and certainly it is these models that are absolutely key, how they're going to be structured, how they're going to be financed. And that's another thing, of course, that we were discussing in Vienna as well, wasn't it, Martin? But, you know, getting the finance available to support these initiatives. Well, look, during this podcast discussion, we've been talking about kind of geopolitics. And you know, we can't have a discussion, of course, without mentioning the terrible situation in Russia, Ukraine at the moment. So why don't we kind of end up by talking about this a bit more? You know, do you think the current Russia-Ukraine crisis, you know, will speed up or slow down the energy transition? And, you know, particularly, what will be the impact on hydrogen in particular?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And we could probably spend about an hour talking about that in general, because there aren't any sort of easy answers, I don't think, on the question of will it speed up or slow down. But I think on balance, and we've spoken to a lot of people, it looks like probably speeding up is more likely to emphasize energy security. So I think the Russia-Ukraine crisis is not helping the situation for gas to make a case for a long-term role in the energy transition. So in the blue versus green hydrogen debate, so that blue being hydrogen made from natural gas with carbon capture and storage, green being made from electrolysis using renewable power. So the message prior to recent developments had been that there was a case for blue hydrogen first, followed by green. And that made sense from an economics and an environmental point of view, because you need the renewable power to decarbonize the power grid first. But actually, the cheaper part doesn't apply right now. But there were some charts shown in Vienna showing that actually at current gas prices, blue hydrogen is just more expensive. And so that would strengthen the case for green hydrogen. But still the need for green hydrogen to be used first to decarbonize the grid, renewable power to decarbonize the grid first before making green hydrogen, that's more important, I think. But another interesting take, though, I think an important geopolitical point, was around, so we want to move away from natural gas because of the concern about imports from Russia. But actually, a lot of the electrolyzer components come from critical minerals, which had come from a small number of countries. And that was something, that was a new perspective, perhaps. So iridium is a limited amount mined every year. Zirconium comes mainly from China, or iridium, by the way, comes from South Africa, some from Russia. We need to be careful, like, looking at it holistically from a geopolitical point of view to really understand, do we really have a robust supply chain for the new direction of travel? I think there was some reassurance that you always mine these things and you can expand the mining activities, but just, I think, underlines the complexity of the whole supply chain question. And so again, to come back to our own research, you know, we're taking very much a supply chain perspective on the whole hydrogen research in order to come up with what business cases will work and where does it make sense and where does it make less sense. So that's kind of overall, I think, a good link between the Vienna conference and our own research.
Yeah, I have to say I completely agree with you. Understanding the kind of supply chains, and also, of course, the move towards resource nationalism globally, which is becoming a key element as well. You know, as always, of course, in the energy transition, as you said in this podcast, there are a lot of questions. I mean, there are a few answers. But, you know, I guess that's what makes research so interesting. And I have to say, you know, you've given us today a real insight into kind of the volume of research that has to be done. And, you know, we will watch with interest how the hydrogen research, which you're heading up at the Institute, moves forward. And again, you know, we will cover these more in podcasts in the future. Well, I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Martin, thank you very much for your time. And thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.